Open the pod shop door, please, Hal. Good time period, fellow netizens, and welcome to the first installment of the Vancouver Public Library's first ever Writer's Pod Shop, the workshop that comes in the form of a podcast. I am Spider Robinson, the Cory Doctorow of the Stone Age, and the Vancouver Public Library's sixth writer in residence, although paradoxically I am recording this in my literal residence, which I call Tottering on the Brink, rather than at my nominal residence, a fifth-floor glass office at the library. That's the ingenious part of the podshop concept. Everyone concerned saves a fortune in gas money, ferry fares, parking, fast food, and overpriced, over-roasted coffee, not to mention exposure to rotten weather and one another's pathogens. I've been producing a biweekly podcast called Spider on the Web for over 2 years now, and won a few awards for doing so. It's basically a mixture of great science fiction and great music, 50-50. Over 80 hours of it are available free at either the iTunes store or my own website, spiderrobinson.com. As far as anyone knows, this is the first time the pod shop has ever been attempted, and so I'm basically faking it without the sheet music. If it works, I'm a genius, and if it bombs, I'm safe at home where they can't get at me. The format is as simple as possible on the principle known as KISS for Keep It Simple, Spider. Each time Hal opens the pod shop door, I will read aloud four manuscripts submitted by brave members of the general public who suffer from a restless, burning urge to write. And worse, to be published. And paid for it. Please bear in mind that the length limitations we had to arbitrarily impose to make this workable mean that most, but not necessarily all, of the manuscripts you'll hear will be excerpts from a longer work rather than complete stories. They should be judged on that basis. Other participants in this pod shop will be encouraged, but not required, to submit their comments on the material I'm reading, and I will read any such comments I receive as well after all that session's submissions have been read. I may or may not choose to throw in my own 2 cents worth at the very end, depending on time and energy constraints. And it is possible that the VPL's esteemed webkeepers may choose to re-edit things so that comments are heard immediately following the story they address. That's up to them. These comments will not be anonymous or pseudonymous, and the writer critiqued will have an opportunity to return fire, though not necessarily in the same Podshop episode. You are encouraged, therefore, to download each Podshop and store it in your iTunes library for future reference. Collect the set. Non-participants who wish to comment on excerpts or on previous comments by participants may certainly post their thoughts on the VPL website, but their comments will not necessarily be included in these pod shops or even read by any of us. I personally advise participants to ignore criticism from non-participants. In any actual workshop I've ever attended, they wouldn't be allowed in the room. I should also mention that if this format seems to work, these pod shops may also appear as part of my regular biweekly podcast Spider on the Web, although there they will be accompanied by an extra half hour or more of very good music, as my regular listeners have come to expect. And now, let the magic start. We begin VPL Pod Shop number 1 with manuscript number 1, Transfection by Christy Cherish. Caden couldn't keep her eyes off the time stamp on the training room wall. Every time she managed to wrench her eyes off the clock and back onto Dr. Rieran, she found her eyes yet again migrating back to the digital time feed above the door. Class is almost over. Caden, is there a problem? Is my class not as riveting as you'd like today? Caden closed her eyes and cringed. Damn it, she saw me. That makes about half a dozen times in the last 15 minutes, doesn't it? Giggles and snickers from the other trainees in the room. Figures I'd get caught this close to the end of class, Caden thought. I might as well let her humiliate me. There are only 30 more seconds before the bell. She sunk lower into her desk and tried her best to look sheepish. Dr. Rieran leaned against the training room console. It still projected the Lyria system trajectories onto the walls of the classroom, showing them their new home in detail. She furrowed her beautifully arched brows and frowned at Caden. Caden sat watching Dr. Rieran open her mouth to speak, expecting her instructor to chastise her, but before she could speak, the end-of-class bell rang. Caden bolted from her workstation and reached the door first as it dissolved. Her relief at escaping her instructor was short-lived. "Caden, can you stay back for a moment?" Caden hesitated, trying to decide whether to leave for the week or attempt to have a conversation with the bitch queen. "Please," Dr. Rieran pleaded. She crossed her arms, and a more sympathetic expression than Caden was used to seeing crossed her instructor's face. Caden knew it wasn't a request, so she reluctantly stayed behind as the other students piled past her out into the hall. "I'm sorry to have to say this, but we need to talk about your application to the Lyria survey team, Caden." Caden thought she could see her instructor fidgeting in place. "You have to understand that all the survey equipment we have is designed to use an optical interface." She looked expectantly at Caden and waited for a response. Caden didn't see the relevance. The doctors kept her eyes condition under control, and she had no trouble using the interface. Dr. Rieran cleared her throat, breaking the awkward silence that had fallen between them. "Survey teams spend most of their time readying planet quadrants for terraforming, often for weeks at a time, but it sometimes turns into months, and we just can't guarantee that you'd always have access to medical treatment. With your condition, that's a serious safety concern for you and the entire team." Caden stood in front of her instructor, mute and numb. She understood now why the doctor had seemed so uncomfortable. "It's been lovely having you in my class, Caden, but I'm afraid you need to transfer into one of the other project streams." Caden thought the floors had been pulled out from underneath her. She stood still in the classroom with her feet firmly planted, but her body said she was in a gravity-free fall. "I'm so sorry, Caden." To the doctor's credit, she looked genuinely sad to see Caden go, in spite of all the times Caden had been a source of frustration for her in class. Her mouth too dry to speak, Caden nodded and left the survey classroom for the last time. The other students in her class hadn't lingered in the hallway. Caden was alone, standing suspended amongst the stars that were projected from outside the ship. Still in shock from losing her position as a surveyor trainee, Caden made her way down the upper corridor toward the garden to see Nisus, the only person on the ship she wanted to talk to right now. Hands shoved deep into her flight suit pockets, she avoided making eye contact with the crew she passed. She couldn't bring herself to take the flight suit off and admit defeat. She hoped Nisus would have some ideas of how she could get Dr. Rieran to reverse her decision. When she reached the entranceway, two guards posted outside the garden entrance signaled for her to give them her clearance badge. It mattered little that they knew her by name, that they checked every time as part of security protocol. She'd hate to be Nisus, guarded 24 hours and restricted to this place. Anything to safeguard the ship's genetic investment. Although I'm probably the only one who even bothers to visit. The door dissolved, and Caden passed through into the top tier of the gardens. Instead of the star-filled walls and ceilings of the classrooms and hallways, the garden ceilings suspended lattices of crops that Caden could only partially identify. She scanned the upper floor and walls for a metallic reflection off the tendrils that made up Nisus's hair, or a glimpse of white, spider-like limbs peeking from amongst the green foliage. He was nowhere to be seen. He must be on the lower levels today. As she descended through the second level, a plant caught her attention she thought must be new. A thick green stem reached the 20 feet from the bottom soil deposits and held a single flower, or maybe even a seed pod. The pod was pale green and large enough to hold a person. Caden didn't think she would have missed it last time. It's definitely one of Nisus's creations. His style is written all over it. It even looked like he'd lined the flower's mouth with teeth. When she finally reached the lower level, she thought she saw Nisus's slender arm bent into one of the trees. "Nisus, is that you in the tomato tree?" The arm gave way to a slender torso, much taller than Caden. A heart-shaped face peeked over the branches and focused its metallic cat's eyes in on her.
"This is the wrong section, Caden."
His mouth barely moved as he spoke. She still found the lack of movement unnerving, that and the metallic voice they'd given him. "Huh? The wrong section for what?"
"The tomato trees are in the third quadrant. This is the eighth. That means this is a pepper tree, not a tomato tree."
Nisus lowered himself from the branches and glided over to where Caden stood at the bottom of the stairs. Caden thought he looked perplexed, or more so than usual. Nisus often proved impossible for her to read. His face couldn't quite form the shapes necessary for most human expressions. "What are you doing to them?" she asked. Nisus's eyes widened at the mention of his experiments.
"I'm trying to increase the protein yields."
"By how much, Nisus?" Caden frowned. Modifying protein yields was tricky. She remembered at least that much from agricultural biology. As the protein content went up, you ran the risk of stripping the soil.
"At least 60%, maybe more."
Caden gave an appreciative whistle. "Very cool, Nisus, except for the fact that it'll kill the ship's soil supply. Are you intentionally trying to starve all us humans off?" She raised an eyebrow, their signal for when she was joking.
"No," he said, "or at least not intentionally."
He winked back. Caden covered her mouth to stop from laughing. The wink looked foreign and comical in an unflattering way. Nisus continued,
"I've got a new kind of nitrogen-fixing bacteria. They're very responsive to UV light. The various wavelengths induce different yields of protein. Once I figure out which one gives the most efficient yield and which strains will fit best..."
Nisus trailed off as he noticed Caden shaking her head.
"You lost me at nitrogen fixing, Nisus."
Caden shrugged. Nisus sighed and brought the microscope images up on the overhead console. She watched the rapidly spinning cells fluoresce in waves across the screen.
"Very pretty. What's with the light show?"
"When you expose them to light, they make protein."
He waited for Caden to acknowledge that she understood, then continued,
"I'm infecting different crops with the bacteria and measuring the increase in protein in the fruits and vegetables."
Caden couldn't help but be impressed. "The biolab will have to give you something for this, Nisus. Maybe they'll even give you ship's access this time," she said hopefully.
"That would be nice, Caden, but I highly doubt that will ever happen."
He inclined his head toward the two guards who stood on the upper tier. "Not just here to keep people out, but also here to keep him in." Caden tried to switch the topic.
"The bugs are good, Nisus, but I think the giant flower pod beats them out," Caden said.
Nisus looked confused and twisted his head to a 90-degree angle. He narrowed his eyes, using the sheer membranes adjacent to his eyes as eyelids.
"What flower are you talking about?"
Caden pointed to the giant yellow-green stem by the staircase that supported the giant pod she'd seen on her way in. Nisus's eyes followed the arc of her hand.
"Ah, that flower. It's a tissue repair casement I'm working on for the medical wing."
He placed his face close enough to Caden's ears that he could whisper,
"They might even use it on you if it works."
Caden felt a little taken aback. Looking at it was one thing. Entering it...
"It has teeth," she said.
"Those are breathing tubes, not its teeth,"
Nisus said, still whispering. She shrugged, not convinced. Nisus got up and headed towards the staircase.
"I need to go check on one of the other tiers. I'll be back in a minute. You'll stay, won't you?"
Nisus asked, an imploring look on his face. She nodded. Of course she'd stay and visit. Caden was left alone with the microscope. Her eyes drifted back to the bacteria, still fluorescing on the screen. They were fascinating. She couldn't help going over to the scope where the bacteria were held and looking into the eyepiece. They were more beautiful than they were on the screen, whirling around at speeds she'd never seen in bacteria before. 10 minutes passed as she stayed captivated by the spinning creatures. The force that pulled Caden off the scope forced her to lose her balance and collapse onto the soft dirt.
"Caden, what have you done?"
Nisus was bent over her, a light-emitting tool in his hand as he peered into her eyes and face. He stood up and pulled Caden over to the water outlet. He forced her, clothes and all, under the icy stream.
"Nisus, what's wrong?"
She stood shivering as he continued to probe her with the light device.
"Hopefully nothing."
His face was very close to hers, and every muscle was tense as he inspected her hairline to her jaw, then her hands and fingernails. Satisfied nothing was wrong, he loosened his vice-like grip.
"Those are live samples, Caden. The bacteria aren't always contained on the slides. I've found them as far away as the eyepiece.
They're no danger to me, but I don't know what they'll do to human tissue."
He shook his head, staring at the ground.
"I'm sorry, I should have mentioned it. They should be in the bio lab still. I just...
Nisus looked down and away as if embarrassed.
"I just prefer to work in here by myself."
"No, it's fine," Nisus, Caden replied. "It's not your fault. You didn't know I would touch the microscope. There's nothing wrong, though, is there?"
She tried her best not to look worried.
"Not as far as I can see."
He held up the light.
"They would have fluoresced by now, I would think."
They spent another half hour chatting when Nisus surprised her as she started to leave.
"So are the rumors true?"
he asked as she headed up the staircase. Caden's body tensed. She'd almost forgotten.
"Did Rhiarran really kick you out of the surveyors?"
He folded his hand elegantly over the railings and balanced his small chin on top. His face looked weightless as he watched her for an answer.
"Wow, this far that fast? This is the bottom of the gossip pile," she added. "No offense meant, Nisus."
"None taken,"
he said, smiling at her. He looked almost human sometimes.
"Do you know what you're going to do yet?"
he asked. Caden shook her head. "I was hoping you'd have a bright idea," she said hopefully.
"Well, your grades aren't good enough for biolab, so we won't be seeing you here."
Caden had to grudgingly agree with him. Biology wasn't her strong suit.
"And as for the other matter," he inclined his head back toward the giant flower, "that's the best I could come up with." "You'll be back tomorrow again?"
he asked hopefully. She didn't like leaving him alone in this place while she was able to visit with other people outside. She nodded and left the garden on her way to her mother's quarters. Independent juvenile quarters agreements were assigned on the presumption that said juveniles would visit each parent once a week minimum. Caden had managed to avoid her mother Casey for an entire month. She cringed as she tapped the door console and waited for her mother to answer.
"It's me, Casey, your reproduction unit."
She waited for her mother to release the door field.
"Caden, come in. I haven't seen you in weeks now. Aren't you supposed to be coming by every week, at least? Should I be reporting you?"
Casey smiled, a mischievous glint in her eye.
"You won't report me, Casey. They'd make me move back in."
Caden smiled back. She wished she looked a little more like her mother. She hadn't made out quite as well in the looks department. Her mother looked incredibly well this evening. She'd never realized quite how blue Casey's eyes were before now. "Is that how my eyes look?"
"Caden, I heard about Dr. Rhiarran kicking you out of the surveyor. Don't worry, I've already got you an appointment."
Her voice trailed off. As Caden walked into the main room, a perplexed look caught hold of Casey's face. She crossed the floor and grabbed Caden's chin in her hand and pulled her to the center of the room. The glass Casey had been holding shattered to the ground. A manic look caught hold of Casey as she ran to the main wall console.
"Medical emergency in quarters 3012. Patient Caden Cass undergoing degenerative retina treatments. I need a team here now."
Caden watched as her mother grew angry at a voice she couldn't hear on the other end.
"No, I can't bring her there. Her eyes are having an allergic reaction. The pigments have changed and they've glassed over."
Caden saw tears forming in her mother's eyes. That was Transfection by Christy Charish, or Charish, or some third variant I haven't thought of. Thank you, Christy. VPL Podshop number 1 continues now with manuscript number 2, Perihelion by Stephanie Cruz.
I looked, and behold, the sun became black as sackcloth made of goat hair, the full moon became like blood, and the stars in the sky fell to earth. Revelation 6:12.
Cadiz struggled to free herself of the watchman's grip. She kicked and punched, but the old man's arm wrapped around her like a rigid ancient branch.
"Let my Nana go," she said, still fighting. "Don't take her away."
But Nana was just as helpless and more confused than Cadiz. She mimicked her granddaughter's actions, arms flailing amongst the many hands seizing her, shouting, eyes frantic. Gali stood rooted behind the crowd, inert yet trembling.
"Please, let her go."
The old man restrained Cadiz.
"Your grandmother is a sorcerer and a danger to our society. She must be punished. To the asylum."
The townsfolk holding Cadiz's grandmother motioned as one and dragged her outside the dome house into the bitter cold of the night and toward the asylum. The watchman had released Cadiz and followed behind. Cadiz ran after them shouting, but was knocked to the ground by the watchman's staff. She touched her warm, pulsing forehead and felt a trickle of blood hugging the contours of her brow. She looked up at his icy gray eyes and said no more, blood and tears mixing, rolling down her cheek. Up above, the black sun watched in silence. The woman's screams made Cadiz's hair stand on end as they dragged her through the street. It was as if the nightmare of Nana being taken away had started all over again. But now, old enough at 15, she had to be part of the mob arresting this woman. Khazra was there, but he managed to hide his emotions better than Cadiz did. The air was getting chilly as the moon rose, and everyone hid under their fur cloaks, their visors veiling the view of the sky.
"Take her to the asylum,"
said the watchman, and they followed, leaving behind the woman's husband watching, but not a word escaping him.
"God have mercy," they chorused.
Cadiz held her by the hand, the woman's nails digging into the back of her palm, slowly drawing blood. She dared not look at her, and repeated the words over and over, louder and louder, so she couldn't hear her own thoughts. But it didn't work. She looked at the moon. "So what? You've been doing that way longer. Geez, even Nana taught you to look at the moon. Why are you doing this?" Cadiz closed her eyes shut. She couldn't fight the thought of the woman under her mercy being Nana. "Nana, this is for Nana." The mob halted. Cadiz opened her eyes to see the watchman before them standing by the edge of a cliff, eyes closed, his staff raised to the sky. Her heart raced. She looked to Khazra, whose face was blank as a wall. Where was the asylum? By now the woman's protests had died down into pathetic sobs.
"God forgive this woman's soul, for she has been moonstruck."
He opened his eyes and focused them on the woman.
"We punish her in your name."
The woman's eyes widened, and she began screaming again in full force.
"This is wrong."
As one, the mob lifted the woman above their heads and dropped her over the cliff. Her eyes caught Cadiz's before she descended. Then, in a second, there was a loud thud, and her cries were no more. Cadiz felt her head and stomach spinning. Khazra caught her. They began praying. Cadiz ran home. The red moon hung over the sky as town slept. Cadiz grabbed her long fur cloak from the wall, removed her telescope and star charts from the drawer beneath the bed and placed them inside a cloth sack. She walked to the door but stopped upon seeing Ghali watching her, frowning. "You can always come along if you want. It'll be like when Nana taught us," Cadiz said. Ghali shook his head and tugged on her sleeve. "I don't want you to go," he said, beady eyes pleading. "I won't take long, I promise. Wait for me here, okay?"
"Be careful, Cadiz," he said.
Cadiz nodded and kissed him on the forehead. She stepped outside, sneaking past the sleeping houses, and made her way into the vast expanse of sand and winter chill that was the desert. Khazra's cloak fluttered in the night breeze as he stood over the endless desert, brass telescope directed toward the stars, then looking down at his charts and recording. His attention shifted to Cadiz running uphill, shivering in the cold.
"That was quite the display of faith you showed back there. I'm sure that woman appreciated you running away before praying for her." He smirked, his gray eyes twinkling with mischief.
"I know. I'm sorry," Cadiz said as she removed her telescope from the cloth sack. The model was older than Khazra's and rusted in color. It was Nana's, but she passed it on to Cadiz when she taught her astronomy. "But at least now I know what asylum really means and how my Nana died." Khazra's smirk disappeared. He stared at his friend, gazing at the moon. "Hey, come on." Cadiz put her telescope down and unrolled her chart, her hands shaking.
"That woman, she looked at me, and I couldn't help but see Nana's face and feel like that was my grandmother, and we threw her over the cliff. It made me sick."
"Would you have felt better if it was a man instead, so you could throw rocks at him and imagine the watchman's face?" Khazra said.
But Cadiz was still engrossed in the dead woman's eyes.
"It's like she knew I could help her, but I didn't."
Khazra wrapped an arm around her shoulder. "Don't let it get to you. This is only your first time. There'll be other times, trust me, and you'll have to get over seeing anyone you love on the face of the person you punish, whether you're throwing them over a cliff or stoning them to death." She wiped a tear. "You're right, I'm sorry." Cadiz glanced at the moon and furrowed her brows together. "Khazra, does the moon look redder to you, or is it just me?"
Khazra looked above.
"Yeah, it does. It's gotten brighter, too." Cadiz spread out her charts over the sand. "What the hell is causing it?" Before Khosra could offer an answer, a light from the town caught their attention and seemed to be coming their direction. "The watchman," Khosra said. "Pack up and let's go." Cadiz obeyed and shuffled to get her charts and telescope back in the cloth sack, while Khosra slid his telescope inside his cloak's pocket, the device dangling. They ran back panting, breaths escaping as steam and disappearing in the fog that was slowly enveloping the desert as they circled the town to avoid the watchman. They made it to the town in silence and returned to their respective homes. The watchman stood on their former spot, and in his hand was a golden telescope made of brass. The moon escaped from the morning sky, making way for the sun, when Cadiz heard the uproar. She peered through the shutters to see the townsfolk crowding around the watchman, their angry voices muddling in indistinct chatter.
"What's happening, Cadiz? Why is everyone so loud?" Ghali said, rubbing the sleep from his eyes.
The watchman stood on a platform before the townsfolk, his long black cape skimming the ground, rosary dangling from his neck. His translucent white hands reached for his pocket and produced a broken instrument, a telescope. Cadiz gasped.
"Someone in the town has been dealing with sorcery?" a woman said.
Ghali turned to his sister. Cadiz knew the question in his eyes, but couldn't give him an answer. The watchman nodded.
"We must find the traitor and rid the town of him, or God shall surely punish us."
They chorused in fear. The watchman rang the bell behind him, and the rest of the townsfolk, children, teens, and other adults emerged from their houses and gathered in the plaza, joining the crowd for the morning prayer. Cadiz brought Ghali a loaf of bread and a glass of water while he dressed into his tunic and slacks. Her thoughts drifted to Khosra and groaned. "Come on, eat something first before we join them." Ghali refused the food before him. "I'm not hungry," and he stepped outside the door, joining the rest of the town at the plaza. Cadiz laid the bread and water on the bedside table, covering the glass with a coaster. She stepped outside and followed Ghali to the plaza. She prayed and sorted through her mind ways to gain her little brother's forgiveness. On her way, she spotted Khosra's face in the crowd, distraught. She stopped beside her brother, who was already praying with his rosary. "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." Cadiz pulled out her rosary and closed her eyes, ignoring the heat, drowning the questions in her mind in the townsfolk's prayers.
"You didn't try going to the desert, did you?" Khosra said when he opened the door to Cadiz's worried face.
Cadiz shook her head. "There's no way, not with the old man circling around the town like a hawk."
Khosra led her inside his house. It was similar to every house in town in shape and decor, windows, shelves, and a small altar with a cross and a portrait of Christ leaning against the window. Only a portrait of his mother and father suspended on the wall and picture frames scattered about discerned his home.
"What are you going to do?" Cadiz said.
"Getting my telescope back is what. I'm not letting that prehistoric bastard have it. That was my dad's."
Cadiz's eyes focused on the family portrait hanging on the wall. Khosra was much younger in the picture, smiling between his mother and father. She looked back at him. "You haven't gotten over your parents."
"Course I haven't," his tone took Cadiz aback. "Stupid watchmen, stupid, ignorant townsfolk. What do they know? God, it just feels like the world today stops spinning, and here we are in a dead zone, stuck with the stupidest people on earth. They might as well be if they can't listen to reason."
It was Cadiz's turn to lend Khosra an arm. "Then we just have to speak louder to get through to them. The truth is out there, and we're going to find it." Khosra exhaled.
"You're right. I'm sorry about that. Have you got any ideas why the moon's turning red?"
He pulled out his charts from a drawer where the altar sat. Cadiz looked up at the ceiling as if the moon were there. "Maybe a lunar eclipse?"
Khosra snorted. "It's one hell of an eclipse to last more than a couple of hours max. Try again."
Cadiz looked sheepish as she contemplated offering her next guess. "Maybe the moon's getting closer?"
Khosra looked up from the chart on his lap. "Possible." His hands crumpled into fists.
"If only I had my damn telescope!
Hey, come on. We just have to wait until this commotion's done, and then we can research again. I've got to get back to Ghali."
Cadiz made for the door, and Khosra followed her.
"Don't do anything stupid."
"Like what?" he said, his eyebrows raised.
"Like trying to get your telescope back."
Khosra rolled his head back.
"I won't get caught. Besides, I'm way too fast for that guy. Nothing's going to happen."
His tone lightened. "Now go home and don't attract any noise, or you might get caught."
Cadiz crept through the alleys, heading home. She shook her head. Sometimes Khosra's humor was more dangerous than it served him. Cadiz pulled the veil over her face as she prepared for the stoning. The rocks sat collected on her arm, and one by one she hurled them at the victim, releasing her anger and anguish. Imagining the watchman being stoned instead of Khosra was all she could do to keep her from pushing through the crowd and protecting him. She could not have been more grateful to have the veil hide her paling face, eyes red from tears.
"May the Lord damn your soul to hell! Kill the sorcerer! Kill him and God will forgive us!"
Shout after shout, their words pierced Cadiz's heart like burning arrows. The rocks fell on the ground. She watched Khosra's motionless figure, huddled over the sand, so quiet. Revealed above his arms were those same gray eyes that once twinkled with mischief, but was now devoid of light and frozen in fear. Cupped in Khosra's hands was his father's telescope. "You'll have to get over seeing anyone you love on the face of the person you punish, whether you're throwing them over a cliff or stoning them to death."
"This is the will of God bringing justice."
The watchman bowed his head, arms raised towards the heavens. Cadiz turned away and collapsed on her knees and faced the sand as well. The onslaught didn't die or slow, and they continued stoning her friend to far beyond death. In the midst of all the shouting, yelling, and rocks hitting bone, she could hear Khosra's voice repeating those words to her. "I sometimes feel like the world suddenly stopped spinning, and here we are in a dead zone." And she felt what he felt, so clearly. She fled before the ceremony finished, fled from the dead sorcerer and the will of God punishing him. Up at the night sky, the moon burned in anger. Cadiz met Gali at the door, leaned against it, and melted to the ground, her head buried in her chest. Gali knelt beside her, talking to her and shaking her, but Cadiz remained still as a wall. "Cadiz, what's wrong? Cadiz!" His voice quivered. "This is all his fault. He kept taking you away from me. I don't want to lose you like we lost Nana, Cadiz. Say something!" He laid his head on his sister's knees and cried. Cadiz raised her head and put a hand on Gali's head. "I'm sorry, Gali. Don't worry. You won't lose me." The days passed in silence again. The people had become their calm, catatonic selves once again, sequestered in their tiny world, hiding and praying. The watchman stripped Khosra's house of all of his possessions. Family portraits, pictures, clothing, and charts burned by the altar at the plaza, a peace offering to God. No one ever spoke of him, or the event of his punishment. They were to forget the sorcerer and everything about him, starting with his name. Cadiz spotted her reflection in the window. Her face had aged, sleep losing its grip on her. She abided by the law, never speaking his name or of that night's events. Nothing but survival. That was Perihelion by Stephanie Cruz. Thank you, Stephanie. Rounding the clubhouse turn now, VPL Podshop number 1 continues with manuscript number 3, The Liquid World, a novel excerpt by Pat Dobie. Chapter 1. Harry Roberts sat at a window table in the railway club and poked his drink with a long forefinger. A maraschino cherry bobbed atop mud-colored liquid, the boardwalk breezer, dark rum, banana liqueur, and pineapple juice, from page 114 in The Complete Bartender. He was here with Evelyn, a woman from work. This in itself was astonishing, that she had agreed to come for a drink with him. He'd asked her on the way out of the office, bracing for disappointment. You have to be able to take rejection from women without arguing. But she had said yes, and here they were, sitting together like an old married couple. Evelyn had a beer in front of her and was glancing over the headlines in the newspaper someone had left at the table. Harry sipped his drink, evaluating the musty taste of dark rum that bled through the other flavors. He felt at peace for the first time that day. The railway club felt like a secret place. The entrance was downstairs, a heavy wooden door under a red awning between a 7-Eleven and a pizza shop. It opened into a dark wood-paneled stairway. At the top of the stairs, another heavy door was always propped open. Inside, the window tables overlooked a busy intersection deep in Vancouver's downtown core. During the day, the club's dusky atmosphere seemed to recall an earlier, more interesting time. Outside, the rain had turned into a downpour. Water ran ankle-deep into the gutters. People without umbrellas had taken shelter under awnings and in doorways. This was the kind of rain that fell here every day between Halloween and Christmas. It was the kind of rain that felt as if you were taking a cold shower with your clothes on. "Did you see this?" Evelyn said, looking up from her newspaper. "Oh, cheers!" She picked up her beer and took a long drink, then peered at Harry's drink with a quizzical look. "That looks good." "It's okay. Did I see what?" They were both soaked. Their coats hung over the backs of their chairs, the shoulders dark with rain. The newspaper was damp from her wet hands, and water dripping from her brown hair smeared the ink here and there. She had soft-looking pale skin and a rosy spot under each cheekbone. There was something about the bone structure in the upper half of her head that seemed absolutely right. Earlier that day, the end of his first week at the Learning Center, he had overheard her teaching math to a girl with some kind of attention problem who kept falling off her chair. Evelyn's kindness had impressed him. He wondered if she was kind all the time. "Do you want the cherry?" he said. "Sure." She picked it off his drink and put it in her mouth, then tapped her finger on the newspaper. "Another foot washed up. Size 15, if you can believe it," she mumbled. "I mean, who has size 15 feet?" A squall of rain hit the window behind Harry. The hair stood up on his arms. He stared at her. "My brother does." "Really?" She pulled the stem out and placed it on the scarred table. "Is he in Vancouver?" "Yep," Harry said, "about 10 blocks that way." He nodded at the window. His reflection in the glass looked ghostly, with dark hair hanging damp around his face and deep eye sockets. "Well," Evan said, "I'm sure he's not the only size 15 in Vancouver." She was probably right. "I'm surprised it's that big," Harry said. "All the other ones were size 12, except that woman's foot, the size 9. "Don't forget the bear paw," she said. "Remember, that was a sick hoax." The severed feet had been washing up on Vancouver's beaches for the last 2 years. Nobody knew why or where they came from. Like everyone else, Harry found it fascinating. Journalists from as far away as Europe and the Southern Hemisphere had come to investigate. "It's the first one in a while," he said. "Maybe I should phone Nathan, make sure he's all right." He was half-joking. The odds of Nathan being a victim of anything were minuscule. Not his big brother Nathan, environmental scientist and all-around golden boy. He tried to remember when they'd last talked. It had been a few weeks. When they were kids, Nathan would have done anything for him, and Harry thought he was the sun and the moon, as their mother used to say. But now Nathan didn't seem to like him all that much, and Harry didn't know why. Evelyn nodded. "Good idea." She took another drink, and when she put the glass down, Harry was surprised to see it was half empty. "Can't hurt, anyway," she said, wiping a streak of foam off her upper lip. A flock of Japanese students took roost at two of the tables nearby. The girls unwound long scarves and shook out their black hair. So did the boys, who looked girlish themselves with their long, pale fingers and thin necks. They seemed so helpless, and yet there they were. They had found the staircase and came up and were looking around for a waitress. "No," he said, "I'm sure he's fine." He should find out more about her. "Have you been at the Learning Center long?"
2 years," she said. "It's good. I like the kids."
Harry nodded. He imagined the two of them at the movies eating popcorn, Evelyn laughing with her head back and her throat exposed. He imagined her naked with the hair hanging down around her face. He saw them in New York City, staying at the Ritz Hotel, where F. Scott and Zelda had lived for those careless months in the jazz age, riding atop taxis and jumping into fountains, spinning around and around on the hotel's revolving door. How annoying that must have been for the other guests, Harry thought. People who did that sort of thing bothered him. He noticed she was looking at his glass again. "Do you want the orange?" he said.
"Sure,"
she plucked it out of his drink.
"You always order this type of thing?"
A faint smile hovered on her lips.
"No."
He wondered if he should explain to her. It had taken him 6 months to get this far into the bees. He was looking for his signature drink, something he could order for the rest of his life. He thought everyone should have a signature drink. For his dad it had been Chivas Regal, 2 solid inches in a crystal glass, 3 or 4 a night before dinner. He supposed his dad was a prick, though. He went out for eggnog one Christmas day and never came back. Harry didn't want Chivas. Evelyn pulled the orange rind out of her mouth and drained her beer.
I have to go. She stood up and started buttoning her coat. Soccer practice, rain or shine. You're kidding me. He looked out the window at the rain wiggling down the glass. Who in their right mind would play soccer in this downpour? It was a brush-off, he realized. I wish I was kidding, she said. Thanks for the drink. See you on Monday? She was struggling with her top button. You going to be there for a while? Depends on how long it takes them to find someone. He'd been there 5 days so far, typing up psychoeducational reports. As temp jobs went, it was a good one. Everyone left him alone, and he could listen in on the teachers. Already he had learned more geography than he had in 5 years of high school. Well, maybe it'll take them a long time. She smiled up at him. Harry leaned down and fixed her collar for her. Her eyes looked startled. I hope so, he said. Thanks for coming out. He watched her walk away, then sat down again and took out his cell phone. He should have called before now, anyway. Maybe Nathan would invite him over for dinner. Nathan's phone rang twice, then a message came on saying his voicemail was full. Harry tried his work number, but the switchboard was closed and he ended up in a voicemail loop. It wasn't unusual for Nathan to let his phone take messages, but the full voicemail was not like him at all. He was a stickler for keeping his life orderly. Harry pulled on his wet coat and picked up his umbrella and the newspaper. He lifted a hand to Ian on his way out. "Hey," Ian said, pulling a beer. "That was fast. What happened?" Ian was short and sturdy, with raccoon circles around his eyes, a darker pigmentation than the rest of his face. "She has soccer practice. I'm going to Nathan's." At Ian's look of surprise, Harry added, "I'll tell you tomorrow." Outside, the streets were black and shiny, and the rain fell in fat, steady drops interrupted by gusts of wind. Harry tried calling again as he walked along Melville Street through a tunnel of empty office towers. Next, he tried his mother's number, his hand wet and slippery on the phone. His arm was soaked right through to the skin. He needed a good raincoat with a thick lining, but aside from the money problem, he didn't like how they looked. A car swished slowly by. A girl sat on the passenger side. He could see her white face through the rain. She stared at him as the car passed, turning to keep him in sight. He hugged the building, trying not to get sprayed. There was still no answer except the recording that said Nathan's voicemail was full. Nathan owned a townhouse in the West End, near Stanley Park. Each unit opened into a central outdoor atrium. A metal fence about 8 feet high surrounded the lot, and a security gate closing the atrium off from the street. Harry leaned on the buzzer, thinking about what he would say when Nathan answered. He could shout, "Let me see your feet!" After the first long buzz, he waited a minute. He could hear the rain dripping off the eaves. Drops trembled on the brim of his hat and fell. He leaned on Nathan's buzzer again.
"He's not there," a voice said.
It wasn't coming from the intercom. Harry turned around and saw a pair of eyes peering at him from inside a tree across the sidewalk. The tree was an evergreen of some kind, with long branches sweeping down to the grass. The light from the street lamp was enough to show him the eyes and a white hand holding aside a branch.
"Pardon?" "He's not there. You're trying to get a hold of Nate, right?"
He let go of the branch and disappeared. The branches thrashed back and forth. Then a man emerged, bent over. He straightened up and crossed the sidewalk.
"Hi, I'm Malcolm, friend of Nate's. I see you're buzzing him."
He had a jaunty air about him that seemed to say coming out of a tree was perfectly normal. "Hi." Harry paused, wondering whether he should talk to this person.
I'm Harry. Nate's brother, I figured. Same height. It must run in the family."
Their dad had been tall from the few pictures Harry had seen and the little he remembered.
"I suppose."
He wondered how this person Malcolm knew about him.
"Have you seen him lately? Do you live around here?"
Malcolm laughed.
"I live around here, sure," he said, gesturing at the tree. "If you mean here in this beautiful hemlock. What day is it? Friday? Okay, so I got down from Prince George on Thursday, so it's been 8 days. Nate said I could crash with him. We go way back."
Malcolm looked like a street person. Dirty hands, a patchy beard, clothes that didn't fit. His pants were rolled up, and he wore muddy white running shoes with black socks. The hood of his raincoat flopped around his face and made it hard to get a good look at his features, but Harry could see that he had big round eyes behind thick spectacles.
"Really? You were going to stay with Nathan?" "Nate, yeah," he corrected. "He's good that way. When he knows you need to dry out, he's there to lend a hand. Well, he's been there, you know."
Malcolm's eyes sharpened behind their rain-spattered lenses.
"Or maybe you don't know."
"Dry out from what?" Malcolm studied Harry for a minute, taking in his sodden leather coat and pork pie hat, the tattered umbrella.
"What do you want him for?"
"I just do." Harry didn't believe Nathan would let this street person into his townhouse. "Family stuff." "Your mom? She all right?" Malcolm suddenly sounded genuinely worried. "Nate said she's getting old. Did something happen to Vera?" Harry was surprised. "No, no, she's all right." A taxi pulled over. They both watched a young woman get out, laughing, and run toward the security gate with her keys in her hand. She stopped laughing when she saw them. "Sorry," Harry said. They moved aside. "No problem." She put the key in the lock, looking back over her shoulder at the taxi, then banged through the gate. "I'd let you in, but you know what it's like." She checked that the latch was closed behind her.
"Sure, yeah,"
Harry said. Malcolm muttered the same thing. When she was gone, he said, "Yeah, so he wasn't here last Thursday when I got off the Greyhound. He said he'd be here. I figured I'd better keep trying. I tried sleeping in the park, but my tent got stolen. Then I tried the shelter, but there's too many psychos. Now I'm in the tree." They both looked at the hemlock. Harry tried to picture how someone could live inside its branches. "I've buzzed him pretty much around the clock, and there's never any answer." Malcolm tugged on the gate. "I'm sticking around until I find out what happened to him." He shivered, shifting from foot to foot in wet runners. The rain pattered on his coat, one of those green rain slickers they sell for emergencies. Harry tried buzzing again, wishing he'd asked the girl to let them in. Still no answer. He took out his cell phone. It went straight to the recording. "I'm going to have to come back tomorrow," he said. Malcolm nodded and turned away.
"I'm going back to my stuff." He moved toward the tree. "It's a little drier in there."
His narrow, sloping shoulders barely filled out the slicker.
"Wait a minute."
Harry fished in his pocket and pulled out some crumpled bills, a 20 and a 5. Malcolm half turned, but looked as though he'd just as soon get back to his tree. Harry held out a 20.
"I don't know. Would this help any? Maybe get a hot meal?"
"Sure, thanks." He took the money, then stood looking at Harry. "I need to wait for him so I can dry out," he finally said. "Nate said I could detox at his place. It's heroin, to answer your question." Harry wondered how Nathan knew a heroin addict. He wondered if he should ask for his 20 back in case Malcolm spent it on drugs.
"You don't remember me, do you?"
He peered at Malcolm's face under the hood. Pale skin, sandy hair. Those bulging eyes did remind Harry of someone, but he couldn't think who.
"Afraid not," he said. "Have we met?" "Lord Byng High School," Malcolm said. 2 years ahead of you, Nate's class."
Harry looked again.
"Shit," he said. "No way."
"Yes way."
Malcolm nodded, his hood flopping. "Malcolm Cunningham, I wasn't going to tell you. You know how it is." He paused. "Haven't exactly made a success of things."
"Me neither."
Well, it was comparative, really. Compared to him, Harry was a winner. Compared to Nathan, he was a loser. Compared to most people, he was a loser. There were not many men his age who worked as an office temp.
"Me and Nate never hung out in high school," Malcolm went on, "but we hooked up in rehab and we stayed in touch ever since."
"Rehab?"
Yeah, we were both in the Maple Ridge Treatment Center in the same, what do you call it, cohort? The same intake group."
"What?" Harry rooted around for clarification. "You mean as patients? For drugs?"
"Yeah," Malcolm nodded. "You know what Vancouver's like. Drugs, drugs, drugs. I mean, how do you not get a habit, you know? That's my question."
"Right." Nathan was always busy, a little impatient, kind of distant, as though he had a million other things he'd just as soon be doing. He liked to be by himself. Harry pictured him sticking a needle in his arm, buying drugs, shooting up in an alley. It gave him a strange feeling, as though there might be a whole other reality under the one he experienced.
"When was this?"
5-6 years ago," Malcolm said, "right around when he moved in here."
He stepped closer and put a hand on Harry's arm. "Listen." Harry could feel him shake with the cold.
"I'm pretty sure it's not drugs this time. It took him a few tries, but Nate's been clean for a couple of years. He said he realized one day that it was stop or die."
He let go and stepped toward the tree, then turned around.
"I'll be here except to go score, but I'm just doing the minimum, and I'll come right back."
Malcolm gave him a cheerful salute. The branches thrashed around, and then his thick glasses peered out.
"Safe and sound," he said. "Go home."
"I'll be back tomorrow," Harry said. "If you see him, tell him to call me, okay?" A police car came down the street and slowed down, the cop's face at the window looking Harry over. He walked away. He felt bad about not offering Malcolm his couch, but not bad enough to do it. He decided to walk home across the Burrard Bridge. The umbrella kept getting turned inside out by the wind, so he tucked its broken body under his arm and hunkered into his coat, head down, moving in long strides. The rain drove in his face. Partway across the bridge, he turned and looked at the city core behind him. Lights shone from the high-rises. Everyone was inside, warm and dry. The thousand-acre woods of Stanley Park was a dark hump with an occasional light moving among the trees. The rain eased as he walked under the bridge's central archway, an Art Deco structure of pale stone that looked like castle ramparts. The ocean moved far below. All around was water, the rain from above and the liquid ocean underneath, flowing all around the city's edges and lapping at its shores. Ahead crouched the low rises of Kitsilano.
That was The Liquid World by Pat Dobie, a novel excerpt. VPL Podshop number 1 now enters the home stretch with Good Intentions and with manuscript number 4, Good Intentions, by Michael Donahue. So you probably want to know how it all began. It was trees in the bog that gave me the idea. I was channel surfing one night when I couldn't sleep, as you do, and they had this story about where oil and coal came from. Trees in bogs was one place. Apparently they would fall in and wouldn't biodegrade. Then, over a geologic time span, the trees became coal and oil, vital for energy, farm fertilizer, car tires, cosmetics, and the production of plastic. I think they said one of the reasons this happened was the organisms needed to break them down hadn't evolved yet. So I guess when these trees died, they just sat there, and now organisms have evolved, or were intelligently created, that eat organic matter. Something like that. I didn't get all the details. Then I flipped the channel to some nature doc about this environmental pressure group's sailboat that was sailing into the region called the North Pacific Gyre. It's the part of the ocean where there is a convergence of winds and currents. So, if you throw a plastic pop bottle off the waterfront of Tokyo, L.A., or Hawaii, they will all end up in this one place in one massive vortex of floating plastic trash. And they showed this great Pacific garbage patch filled with plastic grocery bags, pop bottles, and other debris. It was 4 times the size of Texas. Horrific. The yacht Mother Earth took a month to plow through it, but I switched channels after day 3. Still, that was a whole 10 minutes. A long time for me. It may help you to understand I'm Generation Z. I grew up on Xbox 720. I've got the smartest genes money can buy and can count 10 meaningful augmented reality friends for every one physical friend I have. For me, instant gratification just isn't quick enough. So I see a problem, I want to fix it. Which explains why, after seeing that show, I decided to do something about all that floating plastic. Not in an, I'll go and help the cuddly animals who are being caught and strangled or having their insides destroyed by the ingested polymers alongside some chick with dreads and hope to get lucky kind of way, but tackle the actual source of the problem. Nature will create microbes which have the enzymes to eat anything over time, but I wanted to speed up the process so microbes would develop the required biochemistry quicker. It wasn't that hard. I'd made a small fortune from selling a biotech company that uses gene therapy to change your skin color, and now I had time and money, and to be honest, I was a little bored. And you know what they say about idle hands, so I took charge and formed a plan of action. I went augmented reality to talk to some friends on the net who worked in this kind of stuff, did a literary search on PubMed and some other various scientific search engines, pulled up some studies from the UK Royal Society of Geoengineering, and came up with a possible solution. All I needed was to set up a biochemistry lab and get so bioorganisms, which is near impossible with the latest anti-terror legislation. So, I did the modern-day equivalent of putting on a fake mustache and wig. I went online, using a standard 2048-bit encrypted secure Tor-based random key proxy where I routed my traffic between a number of VPN servers, all with IP spoofing. Then I said my name was Mohammed Mohammed and had a bioterrorism plan to kill millions of godless Americans. Could anyone offer logistical help? By the end of the day, I had 31 offers of money and support from various law enforcement and intelligence agencies around the world masquerading as fanatical Islamics, like geeks to the new Star Trek 23 film. So, through the Brotherhood of Martyrs, who, strangely enough, were routing their email out of an FBI.gov server in Houston, I received a shipment of bacteria microbes from the genus Pseudomonas, and from the Sword of Islam, whom I traced back to a server for Homeland Security in Detroit, I acquired microbes from the genus Sphingomonas. I had them delivered to an untraceable drop box with double-blind couriers out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Of course, my suppliers wanted to meet me and my terrorist cell, so I told the Brotherhood to meet us next week in Dubai at the Burj Al Arab Jumeirah Hotel. They'd recognize us because we'd be wearing Mexican hats. Then I told the Sword the same, but that they were to wear Mexican hats so I'd know it was them. That way I didn't need to show up. I hoped they'd not get too upset. After all, they were getting a free trip to Dubai out of this. As far as I know, they could still be there trying to set each other up. I created the biochemistry lab in my upstairs master bathroom. I had to upgrade the bathroom fan and make the place airtight. I won't bore you with the details, but a lot of duct tape was involved. Some plywood over the pseudo-stone double sinks created a workbench where I put a fermenter courtesy of Allah's Will, who seemed to be operating out of the same server the CIA uses. My jacuzzi bathtub became my model of the Pacific Ocean. Then it was just down to screening, genetically engineering, and tweaking some pathways, all of which I've got a lot of experience with from my old company. I don't want to make it sound too simple. It took a long, long time and wasn't without its challenges. I'm not sure if I ever stuck to one project so long in all my life. It must have taken weeks. There was a lot of tinkering with genes, but luckily I had some leftover Thermos Labs on a chip in my garage that came in handy. I admit I was rushing things back then. Maybe I didn't think things through as much as I should. I was getting tired of the screening. Besides, staff at the grocery store near my home were starting to get suspicious. I needed plastic bags like the ones in the Pacific garbage patch, so each day I went to Whole Foods and would buy one item. I'd pay the bag tax and leave with my purchase. But after a while, every time I went in, the security guard would follow me while I made my single selection and head to the tills where it would be swiped, and I'd be asked, "Do you need a bag?" I'd always say, "Yes, pay the 50-cent green tax and leave." I know how unacceptable this was, how you're supposed to reuse the bags or bring your own, but the looks their staff started giving me every day. By the second week, I think if I had been a pregnant woman smoking and talking on my cell, they would have been less offended. It wasn't working, though. I'd modeled it in augmented reality, and everything worked fine. According to the simulation, the plastic bag would break down over the course of a year. But when I dropped it into the tub, and I'd make sure it was full of the correct level of saline at the same temperature as the ocean, it would get carried by the jet streams into the center and just swirl around in this mini-circle. I'd pull it out at set time points and test it, and there would be no change to its structure. It was maddening. I kept trying to increase the virulence of the microbes, but nothing worked. All I was ending up with was a tub filled with water-soaked grocery bags. Then, after another failed session, I pulled out all the bags and decided to get some sleep. It was 5 in the morning, and the sun was just coming up, so I started to brush my teeth before catching a few hours of sleep, when I heard sirens coming from the street below and that unmistakable helicopter sound. I opened the doors and walked out onto my deck. When I looked beneath me, I saw all these cop cars parked randomly on the street, doors left wide open, cars all empty, and then the helicopter dropped in front of me and blocked my view. It was facing me, maybe 30 feet away. I could see the cockpit with the pilot and co-pilot, and then it pivoted and I was face to face with the door gunner. She had this huge rifle with a barrel that must have been as thick as my arm and twice as long, and she had it pointed down at the house on the other side of the street from me. I followed its aim and could see this throng of police officers around the house. I watched as they blew the door out and stormed inside. I stood there for maybe 3 or 4 minutes, waiting for the next bit of drama to unfold, when I felt something tap against my foot. I looked down, and there was my blue plastic toothbrush. I had been still holding it when I went outside. To be accurate, it was half my toothbrush. The other half was still in my hand. I opened up my hand, palm up, and brought it close to my face. My hand was still wet from the tub, and the end of my toothbrush seemed to have been melted away. There was blue water staining my hand like an exploded ink pen. It worked. It worked! And far, far better than I expected or could have predicted. This was wonderful. But why did it work? What was different? Was it fresh air? What? At street level, I saw the cops start to file out of the house. It was pretty far away, but I got the gist of it. It looked like an illegal grow-op. I could see they were pulling out what must have been the tobacco plants wrapped in plastic evidence bags. And then I saw these cops bringing out the lights. That was it. That was it, the light! In my simulations, I had the sun, but inside the bathroom there is only artificial light. No dangerous UV rays. After that, all I had to do was work on the delivery system. If I threw a loaded bottle into the ocean, It would take at least a month to get there, so I settled on using an obscure phage therapy delivery system for my modified microbes, giving them 3 months to replicate and infect before activating the second part of their life cycle, which was when they'd get hungry and start to eat. A lot has been made of me buying the survival supplies, but in fact I only did it because they're green tax exempt. Do the math. I needed 400 plastic bottles, and with the $5 green tax on each one, it was way cheaper to order a 13-month survival kit that came with a daily ration of water, food, and those silly tinfoil blankets, waterproof matches, and flashlights you have to shake like you're masturbating in order to get them to work. Those flashlights were the only things I couldn't resell on eBay 3.0. Once I got the supplies, I emptied each plastic water bottle and loaded them up with the bacteria I'd given life to. Then I looked at the tides, times, and phases of the moon and selected the best date. 2 weeks later, at 4 a.m., I headed down to the beach in a rented moving van. It took a while to offload all of them, but when it was finished, I had a real feeling of satisfaction, like if it didn't work, at least I'd tried to make the world a better place. And I didn't know if it would work. It's one thing to be successful in my bathtub. I knew it would be different in real life, but I had given it my best shot. Besides, while I was waiting for the 4 a.m. departure at home, I was channel surfing and had seen a story about how osteoporosis was dramatically on the rise due to the biomanufactured milk having less calcium. It wasn't until 6 months later I heard the news that the sailboat Mother Earth had made a return visit to show viewers how much worse the problem had become and found the plastic island was now less than a quarter of its original size. They ran this live video feed of the greatly reduced Pacific Garbage Patch, which was on all the main blogs and other news channels. I felt something I'd never experienced before. It was a good feeling. I felt profoundly happy. Yes, I claimed responsibility. Sure, there might have been some ego at play. Maybe I had thoughts that I'd get the Nobel Prize for my contribution to humanity. Perhaps Time's Person of the Year. The only thing is, as we now know, the Mother Earth docked in San Francisco 2 months after the ocean's miraculous recovery, and a month after that, all the plastic in the city started to degrade and break down. Now, within a year, the only plastic left in the world is in that research station in Antarctica. Plastic. It's in all the computers. It lines all the power and phone cables. It makes cars work, planes fly. Maybe I didn't think through all the implications, but, hey, I didn't think that far ahead. I was just trying to do something good, something to benefit all humankind. Problem, solution. That's how I work. That was my only motivation. I didn't do it because I'm an environmentalist. I did it because I'm a problem solver. That's my behavior, and human behavior is hard to change. We can see that with all the pollution we create. How many of you throw away something that is recyclable? It's like picking your nose. You don't want to admit to it, but all of us do it. And for good reason. Something goes into the regular trash rather than the recycle bin because you're already running late, maybe to leave for work or a get-together with friends or family, because it would require rinsing and you're on a water budget, because you've just got home from a long day and don't feel you have the energy to flatten that really strong cardboard box. I was trying to find a scientific solution because that is easier than changing human behavior. And that is why, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I ask that you find me not guilty of these terrorism charges that I face. That was Good Intentions by Michael Donahue, the fourth person you've met today who cherishes a heroic ambition to become the screenwriter, executive producer, director, casting director, set designer, and cinematographer of a movie that takes place entirely in your mind, using only ink stains on paper or dark pixels on a monitor. Before we do anything else, let us salute them one and all for their bravery, for having the audacity to audition in public this way, rather than in the privacy of an editorial office, to commit themselves to listening politely while their baby is criticized by civilians like themselves, people who can't even back up their opinions with a checkbook. Let your comments, if any, be guided by the words of the Dalai Lama. Above all else, be kind. Well, that's a full lid. If you have found these proceedings either instructive or entertaining, join us again on November 23rd for the second exciting installment of the VPL Pod Shop. Between now and then, you might find time to prowl around my website at spiderrobinson.com or order a copy of my latest novel, Very Hard Choices. This is Spider Robinson, VPL Writer-in-Residence version 6.0, thanking you very kindly for the gift of your time and attention. Close the pod shop door, Hal.